Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia.
Perspective on legal frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
He trailed off a little bit there.
Just a dude!
There we go. Finish strong.
Well, you know, it's hard sometimes getting across finish line with one leg. I'm still dragging that one. I wouldn't be worth a darn in a potato sack race.
You might be okay.
A three-legged race.
You'd be okay a three-legged race as long as you had that one tied up, right?
Yeah, just my one and their two.
And you have to have somebody a little bit taller than you with that leg tied up, and you could hit yours up a little bit higher so it wouldn't even hit.
Yeah, but I'd give them my dead one for the one in the middle because it doesn't work anyway.
I don't think that would work. I haven't done a potato sack race in a long time or a three-legged race or whatever.
I hadn't either. I fall a lot.
Yeah, I've thrown eggs recently, but I don't want to talk about that.
What? Thrown eggs? I eat eggs.
I did eat some hard-boiled eggs the other day.
Yeah.
Pretty good.
Well, I love hard-boiled eggs.
They're good for nutrition in the morning for breakfast. They're easy because they're already made.
And you know who really likes deviled eggs?
Who's that?
Our nephew, Dane.
He does.
Do you remember Thanksgiving or Christmas where he ate the entire platter of deviled eggs when everyone was out of the room? We came in and none were left. He ate them all himself.
Deviled egg Dane.
Golly, what a munchkin.
You know, I never liked him until recently.
You never liked him? You didn't like Dane, our nephew?
No.
Oh.
Deviled eggs.
Deviled eggs. Oh, really?
Yeah, I always thought they were kind of gross.
I love deviled eggs.
And then I tried them, and I was like, wait a second. These are really good. I didn't realize what I've been missing.
Yeah, you sure have. Because they are a delight. I love them. I would have eaten the whole tray. The only reason I didn't was just out of respect for everybody else. But apparently, at his age, he was probably about 10 or 11 or something. He had no respect for anybody else.
Well, this has been some time ago.
Yeah, because considering he's probably, what, almost 30 now?
I don't know. He's like a lieutenant in the Air Force, so he's pretty old.
He can eat all the deviled eggs he wants now.
That's right. Well, this episode's not about deviled eggs and hard-boiled eggs and potato sack races and general tomfoolery involved at fairs and carnivals.
Well, that's true. We did get off topic. And speaking of being off topic, I got one other thing I want to bring up before you get into the topic.
What's that?
I have to say that I was completely outraged this week to read in the paper that the woman that was convicted of helping kidnap Elizabeth Smart in 2002 and held her hostage for almost a year while she was raped and tortured by this woman's husband participated in it, she was let out of jail.
Well, that doesn't sound right.
No, it doesn't. I mean, this happened in 2002, so the trial probably wasn't till what, 2003, 2005 or something like that?
Well, 2002 when she escaped?
Well, 9 months after she was kidnapped.
Okay.
So it was maybe 2003. So probably, you know, the way the court system moves, it was what, 2005 or 2006 before they put her in jail or something?
Yeah.
And so here she is already in 2018 and she's getting out?
Well, you say that, but if she was in jail awaiting trial, she would get credit for that time served. So it's possible as soon as she was arrested that that's when her sentence started running.
Well, that's what they did. They went back and calculated that and said, oh, she should get out. Well, I mean, she should have been in 5 more years, but they calculated her time, and so she got out now.
Mm-hmm.
But even if it was 5 more years, that's still too soon. How do you help kidnap somebody and be a party to their torture and rape, and you get out in a reasonable period of time?
Well, those are the big three right there, kidnapping, torture, and rape. Those are pretty high on the whole felony list there.
You would think so, huh?
Well, they are. I know in West Virginia.
That breaks at least a couple of commandments.
Kidnapping's a life sentence in West Virginia.
Well, apparently it's not in wherever they were. Salt Lake City, I guess, is where it took place, Utah.
Huh.
And I thought Utah was pretty tough on those kind of things. But the fact that she could see the light of day again is just beyond me.
Well, I mean, I think she maybe doesn't need to serve the rest of her life in prison, but, I mean, that's pretty quick. 10 years is a pretty short time.
Yeah.
But the thing is, too, is that a lot of these prison sentences, they computate good time. So it means almost you get a day for a day, as long as you're not in trouble. So, you know, if you have a 20-year sentence, it's reduced to effectively 10 years.
Well, that may be, but I think there's certain ones that being good in prison after you participated in such a thing should not count in your favor. That's just unbelievable to me.
Well, this podcast is not about Elizabeth Smart or deviled eggs that we were talking about before.
No, but I am going to be upset about that. So just know I'm going to be thinking about that the whole time we're talking about whatever the subject is.
Maybe if we had some deviled eggs, it'd make you happier. Ease it a little bit.
It would. I'd probably eat them all like Dane did, though.
I like to put bacon in my deviled eggs.
Yeah, that's pretty good, too.
Oh, yeah. It makes like a full breakfast thing.
You know, the ones at Bonhoff, they have like pistachios mixed in the stuff.
Mm.
The stuff in the middle is green. It's not yellow. And they got pistachios in there. So they're pretty tasty, too.
The restaurant that is in the bottom of the West Virginia building, Prime, they have deep-fried deviled eggs there.
Really?
Yeah.
I never tried that, but in West Virginia, we'll pretty much deep-fry anything.
That's true. And we like deviled eggs, evidently.
Yeah, apparently.
So this episode is about some horrible murders that took place in Knoxville in 2007.
Oh, well, that's great.
Yeah, it's kind of a, not really a frivolity type topic, but there's some interesting things that went along with this procedurally that I thought we could talk about.
But all right.
Unfortunately, to kind of talk about this procedural things, we got to talk a little bit about the underlying crime itself, which is a pretty grisly story. So if you have any issues with murder or torture or rape or anything like that, you might want to fast forward for about, I don't know, 4 or 5 minutes. So,
trigger warning.
Yeah, there's not really any way around this, and this is kind of a grisly one. So and the reason we're getting into this is because there's an update now, and this was 11 years ago when this happened. So there's an update now as to something that took place. It's kind of really extraordinary, so that's why we're discussing it today.
Well, you're extraordinary, Mike, so I'm glad that you met this on your terms.
Why, thank you, Tommy. Channon Christian and Christopher Newsom, they were these early 20s, and they were carjacked, tortured, and murdered in Knoxville in 2007. The story is that basically they were leaving their apartment on the evening of January 6, 2007. They were headed to a friend's party, and they were abducted in her Toyota 4Runner from the apartment complex building where she lived. And I guess her parents hadn't heard from her for a couple days, and they went to the mobile phone provider to try to get some
location
data and stuff like that. And they were able to find her 4Runner 2 days later. And while they were looking through that 4Runner, they found an envelope in there, and there was some fingerprint evidence in there, and it led to this man named Lamaricus Davidson. And he had an address that was pretty close to where the car was. So they obtained a search warrant and went there. They found the house unoccupied, but they found her body stuffed into a trash can in the kitchen.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's horrible. Now, so that was Channon Christian, the woman. Now, the man, Christopher Newsom, his body was discovered nearby a set of railroad tracks. He had evidently been bound, blindfolded, gagged, stripped naked from the waist down. He'd been shot in the back of the head, neck, back, and his body had been set on fire. I guess they were trying to maybe hide some evidence or something along those lines.
Man.
And basically, the medical examiner at trial said that he had been sodomized and raped, and they believed that those actions took place at that house, and then his body was later wrapped and abandoned at the railroad tracks.
Those people were animals.
Oh, absolutely. The medical examiner said Christian, the woman, she had died after hours of torture, suffering injuries to pretty much all of her orifices. They poured bleach down her throat. They tried to scrub her body to try to hide the DNA evidence. And they placed her in a residential waste disposal unit, and they covered her with sheets. And some of the evidence said basically that maybe she was still alive when she was there, and she actually suffocated to death in that waste receptacle. So,
man.
I mean, just egregious, horrible, worst case type murder type thing you would ever possibly imagine. Horrible crime. Horrible, horrible, horrible. So, now there were five people actually, but four of them were indicted by Tennessee grand juries. George Giovanni Thomas, and he was indicted and faced a total of 46 different charges. Now, all the different charges against these people, I mean, they stacked all the different charges they could against them. I mean, obviously, they're you know, pretty horrible crimes.
Right.
And he was indicted on 16 counts of felony murder related to the rape, robbery, kidnapping, and theft of Christian and Newsom, 2 counts of premeditated murder, 2 counts of especially aggravated robbery, 4 counts of especially aggravated kidnapping, 20 counts of aggravated rape, and 2 counts of theft. There was a Latavius Darnell Cobbins, and basically he was charged the same basically things. This was Davidson's half-brother. There was a... Oh, I'm sorry, Davidson's the next person. Lamericus Duval Davidson, he was basically charged with the same things. And like I said, he and this Cobbins were brothers. There was a woman named Vanessa Coleman, and she was arrested, and she faced 40 Tennessee charges, 12 counts of felony murder related to the rape, robbery, kidnapping, and theft, 1 count of premeditated murder, 1 count of aggravated murder, 4 counts of especially aggravated kidnapping, 20 counts of aggravated rape, and 2 counts of theft. So they charged these 4 people with, they basically threw the book at them. Anything they could possibly charge them with, they did.
Man.
Now,
did they ever know why they did them? Just was it random?
Well, they get into a little bit at trial. Basically, they were trying to carjack somebody and try to get some money from them, and I guess things just escalated. But, I mean, I don't really, I don't think there was ever really any reason for this.
Well, how could there be any reason to explain that kind of behavior?
Oh, anyway? Yeah. And then the last one, he was not actually charged in state court, but he was rather indicted by a federal grand jury in the Eastern District of Tennessee, and this was Eric Boyd, and he was arrested with regard to the carjacking, and he was not indicted by the Knox County grand jury. So we don't know if there was just not enough evidence to indict him in the state court or what.
So the other 4 had federal charges or state charges, and his was federal.
His was federal.
So what do they say that he did differently than the rest of them? He just helped.
It was carjacking. So I guess basically because there must be some sort of federal carjacking statute that he was involved in. And he was an accessory after the fact of helping the suspects evade the police. So he was carjacking and helping them evade the police.
And so they're saying he wasn't there for all the part in between.
I guess that's what they were trying to say. And there wasn't much, I guess maybe there wasn't any DNA evidence to tie him or anything like that. So he was actually later accused by Thomas and Cobbins that he had actually raped and murdered Newsom. And they got a search warrant for his DNA, but it basically did not result in any additional charges or anything for him at that time on the state level. So that's what they were charged with. Now, back on, there's a whole series of different trials because they were all tried separately. So on April 16th, Eric Boyd was found guilty in federal court of being accessory to a fatal carjacking and for failing to report the location of a known fugitive. He was the only one, as I said, who was not charged with murder, and he was sentenced to the maximum of 18 years in federal prison. And so that was his maximum sentence, just 18 years.
Another travesty.
Yeah, pretty much. But there's a caveat to that story about him, so we'll get to that here in a little bit.
I was going to say, I thought that if you are involved in a felony that results in a death, that you can be charged with the murder.
Well.
And he was certainly involved in felony carjacking. Is a felony.
Evidently, they were not able to charge him in state court. I don't know why they didn't.
So. Sounds like a screw-up.
Well, who knows? Maybe there's something at the end of the story here where they rectify that. Latavius Cobbins, he was in August 25th, 2009. He was found guilty of the murders of Chan and Christian and Christopher Newsom. And he faced the death penalty because he was convicted of first-degree felony murder. And he was found guilty of the facilitation of the murder for Newsom, but was acquitted of Newsom's rape. And the jurors worked about 10 hours on Monday and Tuesday morning before reaching a verdict, and they sentenced him to life without parole. So,
well, that's good.
Yep. Now, Lamericus Davidson was found guilty. The jurors unanimously found him that he should receive the death penalty on the capital charges, 2 first-degree felony murder charges, and the 2 premeditated first-degree murders of Christian and Newsom. And he was sentenced to 80 years for other charges related to the murder as well. And he is, I guess his death sentences were also consecutive. I don't know how that plays out. But if you die and then you come back, we're going to kill you again. Which is kind of a wonky sentence, but there's more to that story too.
So even if you're a zombie, they can still kill you.
Yeah, pretty much. Now, December 8th, 2009, George Thomas was found guilty on multiple counts. The jury returned a sentence of life in prison without the possibility of parole on all the 4 capital convictions for him. And so basically that left just the woman, Vanessa Coleman, to face trial. She was evidently granted immunity by federal authorities for testimony in the federal case on the carjacking. So the federal prosecutors gave her immunity, but the state courts ruled that the federal grant of immunity could not extend to the state charges on murder and rape. So kind of interestingly enough, that's kind of a strange little twist there.
So she didn't get immunity. She still had to stand trial for those other charges.
Yeah.
On a state level.
Yep. And basically she was acquitted of the first degree murder, but found guilty on some lesser charges. And she was sentenced to 53 years behind bars.
Well, all of them must have pointed the finger at that Lamericus, or whatever you said his name was, because he's the one that got the death penalty and the rest of them got less. So they all must have pointed the finger at him as far as being the one that actually killed the two of them.
Well, that's what happens a lot of times in these criminal trials, is that you have multiple co-defendants. Everyone seems kind of like committed to sticking to the story at the beginning, and then like rats on a drowning ship start kind of pointing the finger at each other and whatnot. So, well, now there's some interesting twists to this whole case, and this is why we're bringing it up. So you think, okay, they were sentenced, what, they might have their appeal and that's it, whatever. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a little bit more to the story.
Okay.
The judge who oversaw the trials, a judge by the name of Richard Bumgartner, he was involved in a scandal too.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. He admitted that he was addicted to drugs and had been purchasing prescription pain medication from convicts and was accused by women of trading legal favors for sex during breaks in court sessions. And basically it was determined that these actions were held to have impaired his ability to conduct trials during the final 2 years on the bench and compromised all trials held during his time.
I would tend to agree with that.
And included the trials of those above defendants we just talked about.
Oh, great. So now we're going to let them all out, huh?
So he was disbarred as a result of this, and he was taken off the bench. There's actually a lot more to his story. It involves somebody who, back in 1993, was the district attorney there in Knoxville, and he was killed in a cattle stampede, oddly enough.
In 1993?
Yeah. And so
I can understand 1893.
Yeah. And so the Knoxville DA went and, or the Knoxville judge went and took the position for the Knoxville DA, and that's how this guy came to become a judge. So there's this whole really weird sordid thing about this guy from the very beginning, so it's kind of strange, but we could probably do a whole podcast based just on this guy. But
reminds me of an old Led Zeppelin song.
What's that?
Trampled Underfoot.
I'm not familiar with this one.
Oh, okay.
If I heard it, I'd probably recognize it.
Yeah, because the titles don't match the songs.
No.
They're very indescript.
As I trampled by underfoot. I don't know. But anyway, so there was a new judge, and they made motions for new trials based upon this, and the judge granted new trials to the four different state people, not the one who was convicted in federal court, because that judge didn't hear that one.
Yeah, but that person got the lightest sentence.
He did. So this new judge was Judge Blackwood, and he kind of set some retrials between June and November 2012, pending some different appeals and things that were going on, and he set bail for him at $1 million for Coleman, the only defendant whose sentence had the possibility of parole. He didn't set bail for the other ones, just basically for Vanessa Coleman, because she was the one sentenced to 53 years.
All right.
He had denied any change of venues and allowed potential jurors to be brought in from outside that area, because this was a pretty crazy.
Well, it's so grisly, yeah. I'm sure everybody in the area was familiar with it.
Now, here's an interesting thing. Due to double jeopardy, the defendants faced at maximum the sentences they had already received, and thus that's why only Davidson was actually eligible for capital punishment this time. So, under the double jeopardy clause, I was not aware of this, if you are retried, you can't do worse than what you were already convicted of. So that's why they couldn't come back and try to seek any kind of death penalty for the others, because they'd already had a trial once, and that wasn't their sentence.
So it's kind of like when you take the ACT or whatever, your best score stands no matter what you do subsequently.
Scores can only go up.
Yeah.
So the decision to hold the retrials was affirmed in a split decision by the Tennessee Court of Criminal Appeals on April 13th of 2012. Now, in May, the Tennessee Supreme Court overturned the ruling ordering new trials for Cobbins, Davidson, and Thomas, and commenting that the order should not be construed as condoning or excusing Bumgardner's misconduct. So the decision to hold retrials for Cobbins, Davidson, and Thomas was affirmed in a split decision by the Tennessee Court of Criminal Appeals on April 13th. But in May of 2012, the Tennessee Supreme Court overturned Judge Blackwood's ruling ordering new trials for Cobbins, Davidson, and Thomas, commenting that its order should not be construed as condoning or excusing Bumgardner's misconduct. So the intermediate appellate court said, we agree, and then the Supreme Court said no.
So the Supreme Court said, put them back in jail and let them continue their sentences? Is that what you're saying? Don't give them a retrial?
Exactly. Now, in June 2012, prosecutors filed to have Judge Blackwood recused from the case because he had evidently invoked the 13th juror rule to reverse himself and declined to grant new trials for Cobbins, Davidson, and Thomas, which I didn't know what the 13th juror rule was, but evidently what it is. Have you ever heard of it before?
No. You're the lawyer.
Yeah.
Hell, I barely know where I'm at.
So basically, the 13th juror rule is that in a criminal jury trial in the state of Tennessee, 12 jurors are supposed to determine a verdict. But the trial judge has the duty to act as the 13th juror, not at all to deliberate with the jury, but to basically provide independent layer of review to determine whether or not the weight of the evidence is sufficient. So examining the weight of the evidence requires consideration of a number of factors, including resolving conflicting evidence presented at trial. And if the trial judge determines that the weight of the evidence is against the verdict, the trial judge must grant a new trial. So basically, what this judge did, even though he did not sit in on the trial, he invoked the 13th juror rule to say, I'm going to give them a new trial. And that was the basis for him to do that.
Yeah, but then didn't you say he turned around and said, never mind?
Yeah, pretty much. So it's just really, this whole thing's just really bizarre.
It makes you wonder. It sounds like there were other motives going on.
Yeah. So the motion that the prosecutors filed basically said that Blackwood's emotional involvement in the case is potentially interfering with a fair trial. So maybe based on the egregiousness of everything that he kind of...
Get him out of there, huh?
Yeah, pretty much started getting in there.
So now we need another judge.
So then they brought in Senior Judge Walter Kurtz, and he was named to oversee the retrials and the decisions to grant them, and retrials were denied for Cobbins and Davidson's, but were granted for Thomas and Coleman. So after all that, that's what came up. They got a couple new trials for this Thomas and Coleman. Whew, that's a mouthful. I've been talking a lot.
So were they still on trial, or did they ever have those trials?
She was basically facing, Vanessa Coleman was basically facing the same charges from her first trial, and she was convicted again by a jury of facilitation of aggravated kidnapping, facilitation of rape, and the facilitation of the murder of Channing Christian, but not of Christopher Newsom. And this actually were on lesser charges than her initial convictions, so it actually worked out well for her. She was sentenced to 35 years in prison, minus the credit for time served, and she's eligible for parole in early 2019.
Oh, there's another fine citizen returning to us.
Now, George Thomas, he had another trial, and he had a verdict of guilty on all counts with a lesser charge on count 17, and he was resentenced to life in prison by the jury, but with the possibility of parole after 51 years. So
he could actually get out sometime in the not-too-distant future.
Yeah, well, George Thomas was sentenced to 2 life sentences consecutive for the murders and 25 years multiple concurrent for the rapes. He appealed to the Supreme Court, but they declined to hear his case, so he's not going to get out.
That's good.
Yeah.
At least one of them's in there.
So it was a little bit, I guess it was a little bit lesser, but still pretty solid. So, but yeah, that leads us to Eric Boyd.
That was the one that got only the federal charges and only 18 years. So he probably got out a while back.
You would think so, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Well, that's not the case.
Yeah.
So it appears that either he may have been talking to a buddy of his because when he was in jail, or maybe one of the other defendants talked to somebody in jail or let some beans spill, because there's actually been a new indictment against Eric Boyd as of April 4th of 2018. They indicted Boyd on a 36-count indictment charging him with first-degree felony murder, first-degree premeditated murder, especially aggravated robbery, especially aggravated kidnapping, and aggravated rape in the murders. So basically the same things that the other people were charged
with. Were these state charges or were they federal?
These were state charges.
I guess can you be charged by both? That's not under double jeopardy or something?
Well, he was never charged for anything.
Right. He was never charged with these before.
Exactly. I mean, I guess you could try to argue some sort of collateral estoppel type situation where they should have, if they're going to bring charges against him, they should have done it at that time. But I think that's probably going to fail because it's state versus federal. So there wasn't federal jurisdiction to bring those charges. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, but it's still weird why it ever happened in the first place. There was something fishy going on there.
Well, here's the thing, too. The belief is that basically somebody talked in prison. and there was some sort of jailhouse snitch, and some sort of evidence got out where they could link this guy to it, or maybe something happened. The other thing is, too, is if you remember, they did get some DNA samples from him at some point. But this is back in 2007, but they weren't able to tie him to anything. You know, as technology gets better and better, you might be able to link him to that. And here's one of the interesting things is that on the presentment, the person who is listed, one of the people listed, and this is why there might be some new DNA evidence, is a mitochondrial DNA expert from New Jersey State Police, Colleen Kumar. And she's listed as one of the new expert witnesses. So,
wasn't there somebody that was in prison with him that's writing a book or something?
Well, there is. That was somebody who was in prison with one of the other co-defendants. They're writing about it. So that's why it makes me think maybe that other co-defendant said something to this guy.
And so. And somehow he got the information that that Eric Boyd or whatever his name was more deeply involved than what he was charged with.
Yeah. And it's also possible that Eric Boyd mentioned something to somebody about it, too. You know, he may think, I've gotten off scot-free. This has been 10 years ago. Let me tell you about the time I was involved in this murder that I got away with and never got charged with. And maybe he's telling somebody that to kind of increase his street cred there in jail or something. I don't know. I don't know why you trust anybody in jail, but...
Yeah, because most of the people there are criminals.
They are. And also, you know, in jail or prison or whatever, you don't have any real expectation of privacy there. Unless you're speaking with your lawyer, everything you do is open game. If you send emails to anybody, if you talk on the phone, that's all monitored. I mean, they know, and believe me, they go through it. So anyway, yeah, he was transported from Mississippi and booked into the Knox County Jail and being held on $1 million bond for these charges, which I don't know why he was given a bond in the first place for these charges, because essentially he would have a detainer. Well, I guess the reason he was given...
He might have been out already.
That's true. Yeah.
They might have had to go pick him up somewhere, and he was out.
They probably served this, indicted him right before he's getting ready to get out. So that's probably that's why they gave him a bond, I guess.
Yeah.
Could you imagine that, though? If you're in jail, you're like thinking you're going to get out after some sort of sentence, and all of a sudden, like, nope.
Here comes some more charges.
That's right.
Well, but, you know, he did the crime.
Well, he's...
Or supposedly, allegedly.
Yeah, innocent until proven guilty, but... From where I'm sitting, he looks pretty guilty.
But I don't understand why, if all the other ones were going down for it anyway, why wouldn't they have said something about it at the time? Why would it have to be later on? Why wouldn't they have said something while they were in court? Say, well, he was there too. He did it. Especially if you were that LaMarcus guy or whatever his name was, the one that took the brunt of it, that took got the death penalty. He could point the finger at him and say he did it.
Well, I believe they did. They were basically trying to say he was involved in it to try to help themselves, but... it didn't really matter for whatever reason. You know, I don't know if it was just one of those things that they didn't feel they had enough evidence that they could win, or they felt, hey, we'll let the feds do a little bit of this work on this guy, or what. Like I said, maybe there's some new DNA evidence from the mitochondrial DNA expert. So, I don't know.
But somewhere there was a snitch that got him, huh?
Most likely, I think so.
Well, I did a little research on snitches. And, you know, snitches get stitches.
That's the way the saying goes.
Yeah, I thought that was fairly a recent thing.
What, jailhouse snitches?
Yeah. I thought that was one of those things that modern law has brought about with their, you know, ways of win at all costs and everything. So, but when I read this, that the history of the snitch is long and inglorious. It dates to common law in Old England. Their motives then, as now, were unholy. In the 18th century, Parliament prescribed monetary rewards, which was known as blood money.
Oh.
That's where blood money comes from, is people that were paid money to snitch on others. They'd paid blood money for snitches who were turned back onto the streets, where they were, in the words of one contemporary commentator, the contempt and terror of society.
Really?
Yeah, the system produced a cycle of betrayal in which each snitch knew he might find himself soon in the dock confronted by another snitch. An example of this was the case of Charles Kane, who had provided evidence that sent two men to their deaths in 1755. A few months later, a snitch did unto him as he had done unto the others. And after Kane was hanged in Tyburn in 1756, the clergyman who ministered to him explained that Kane had expected nothing less than hanging to be his fate at last, but not of the evil's day coming so soon.
Let me ask you a question. Now, if you were the first snitch, are you the golden snitch?
Yeah. You're the first snitch.
Okay. Isn't that in Harry Potter, the golden snitch?
It's something like that, isn't it? I've never watched the Harry Potter movies. I've been to Harry Potter World at Universal.
I am the same way.
But everybody had to tell me stuff. I'd look and I'd say, is that person over there, are they dressed as a character, or are they just dressed weird? And Riley would have to tell me, because I don't know. I've never watched the movies.
I've watched part of the first one.
I did ride the ride, though, where we played Quidditch or whatever that game is, where you chase the golden snitch around.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That yeah, was it's in the there. Golden snitch, isn't
yeah.
it?
Oh, yeah. It's not a guy. It's a thing
it's
that
like a
you
ball.
Catch. Yeah,
it flies
it's like
around.
A flying soccer game or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was on that ride the same time with you.
Were you?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I've did it since then. I'll tell you what, it made me about half sick.
Yeah, it's a weird one.
It's one of those 3Ds that it tricks you into thinking you're moving when you're really not, but you're juking back and forth and stuff like that, you know? Up and down and back and forth, and it plays with your head.
That's right. like a snitch does.
That's right. They play with your head. It said, if all cases ended so poetically, perhaps informant-dependent prosecutions would be more humorous than objectionable. In real life, however, O. Henry endings are rare. Consider Joshua Kidden, who came to a decidedly unpoetic end, convicted and hanged in 1754 for the highway robbery of one Mary Jones. After the execution, it was discovered that Mary was a member of a conspiracy to collect blood money. A cohort planted a coin on the hapless Mark, and another apprehended him, and Mary identified the coin as hers. The conspirators then netted £140 per case at the expense of the untold number of innocent lives.
£140?
Yeah. Well, life was cheap in those days.
That's pretty expensive, isn't it?
Well, they got to split it there amongst all the cohorts.
Well,
not each.
In today's world, £140, I believe, is like...
I don't think that's a lot.
£140?
Yeah. Is it? I mean, maybe $140?
Well, I mean, it's probably more than that. It's probably like about $200.
I don't think they had an exchange rate in those days.
But wait, what year is this?
This is 1754.
I'm just going to tell you, $140 in 1754 is a good chunk of change.
Well, they had to split it with all of them.
You know how many radishes you can buy with that much money?
You know how many potatoes you can buy? How many golden snitches? They say the snitch system probably arrived in the New World with the Pilgrims. The first documented wrongful conviction case in the United States involved a snitch. The case arose in Manchester, Vermont in 1819. Brothers Jesse and Stephen Bourne were suspected of killing their brother-in-law, Russell Colvin. Jesse was put into a cell with a forger, Silas Merrill, who would testify that Jesse confessed. Merrill was rewarded with his freedom, and the Bourne brothers were convicted and sentenced to death. But they were saved from the gallows when Russell Colvin turned up alive in New Jersey.
Huh.
So they hadn't killed him. He was still alive. He was just in New Jersey, so he looked dead.
I thought you were going to say they couldn't figure out the Bourne brothers' identity.
The Bourne identity? Is that where you're going with that? Now, America's most infamous snitch was Leslie Vernon White, and it happened in 1989 in California. She was a career criminal, and she faked fake confessions in dozens of cases, worming details about the cases out of police and prosecutors by telephone from jail. In an interview on 60 Minutes, White joked that the snitch system had spawned slogans. Don't go to the pen, send a friend. If you can't do the time, just drop a dime. So that experience shows pretty much what you would expect, that when the criminal justice system offers witnesses incentives to lie, they will.
Yeah. That happens a lot with criminal cases. You'd be surprised how much information people want to share once they're arrested.
Well, it shows that there's 51 people nationally who have been exonerated of crimes for which they were sentenced to death based in whole or part of the testimony of witnesses with incentive to lie. For the most part, these incentivized witnesses were jailhouse informants promised leniency in their own cases or killers with incentives to cast suspicion away from themselves. In all, there have been 111 death row exonerations since capital punishment, which resumed in the 70s, and the snitch cases account for 45.9% of those.
Huh.
And the next highest percentage, you know what it is?
Eyewitness.
Yep. We went over that one.
We did.
Yeah. But there were several of them that just stand out. Here was one where in 1985, it was a double murder, and they put away four people, and it was on the testimony of a purported accomplice, Apollo Gray. And in actuality, she was never there. She was giving testimony so that she could get released for prison on other charges. And so she testified against all these people, and it wasn't until 1999 in DNA testing that all four of them were released from prison because it proved that they were not involved in this. And they paid, Cook County had to pay $36 million to settle the lawsuits filed on behalf of the men, and that was and is the largest civil rights settlement in U.S. history.
And I wonder if they filed any kind of perjury charges against her.
Well, it doesn't say. It just said that she testified against them. When there were some questions, and they got a retrial, and in the retrial, she came back and testified against them again. So she was very persistent.
She was a good snitch.
Here was one where the snitch testified about somebody else being the one that shot somebody at a Chicago tavern in 1985. Well, what they didn't tell everybody is she was the main witness saying she saw this guy do it, this Stephen Smith, shoot this guy. What they didn't say was the police were holding her boyfriend as the main suspect in the murder. But she said, well, I saw this guy do it. So they just went ahead and went with that and convicted him based on this. And nobody ever heard that the main suspect was her boyfriend that she was covering for. Said, finally, in 1999, the Illinois Supreme Court reversed the conviction outright, holding that Carraway's testimony was less reliable than the testimony of the men who were with Willis. Oh, well, the other part of that is she said it was just the two of them.
Right.
The shooter and the guy that the victim. Well, there were two other guys that were there that came and testified. Hey, we were there with him. That wasn't the guy that shot him.
Yeah.
And so they decided that those two guys were more reliable than the lady that tried to testify against him, and so they let him free. Now, here's the one that to me was the topper, though. This guy's name was Daryl Moore. Not much good has ever been said of Daryl Moore. He was a hitman, a drug pusher, a robber, a rapist, a junkie, a parole violator, and perhaps foremost, perjurer for money. That was told us by a Cook County state's attorney. Mr. Moore either beats people, maims them, or if need be, he will kill them for the right price. Rather than protecting society from Moore, however, prosecutors entered into a pact with him. He would testify for the state concerning an alleged contract murder. In return, he would be paid cash, pending drug and weapon charges against him would be dropped, and he would be immunized from the prosecution for a contract murder in which he admittedly participated in. And he would then be turned loose on the streets of Chicago.
Man, he got a sweetheart deal.
Boy, I'll say.
Wonder who his lawyer was.
Now, the deal seemed even ill-advised to Moore's mother. So this is the guy's mother. And she took the stand as a defense witness after her son testified for the prosecution in the murder case. And they asked her, do you know Daryl's reputation for being truthful? And she replied, yes. And they said, is her reputation good or is it bad? She said, bad. And said, would you believe Daryl Moore under oath? And his own mother said, no, I wouldn't. But if Moore had been convicted of the drug and unlawful weapon charges that were pending against him, he would have been his third strike and he would have gone away for a long time.
Yeah.
So do you not think he had incentive to do anything they asked, whether he knew about it or not?
Oh, I'm sure.
So in exchange for the testimony of this man whose own mother would not believe him, the prosecutor set him free and spent some $66,000 in public funds to, among other things, house him and his woman friend in a Holodome hotel. The purpose of the deal was to convict a drug kingpin named Charles Ashley, who allegedly paid two co-defendants to murder a suspected informant. The prosecutor's effort to put Ashley out of business, ironically, were soon rendered moot by natural causes. At the time of his trial, Ashley was dying of cancer. So Moore did testify for the state, and Ashley was convicted of murder and sentenced to spend the brief remainder of his life in prison. His co-defendants, James Allen and Henry Griffin, were also found guilty. and they were later sentenced to death. As their convictions were appealed, Moore recanted, claiming the state's attorney's office paid him to lie as part of a scheme to frame Ashley. In truth, said Moore, he knew nothing of the crime of which Ashley Griffin and Allen had been convicted.
So he double-crossed them.
Yeah, he came out after he was free and said, oh, by the way, I lied about all that.
He's just trying to set things right.
So before he recanted, however, with the freedom prosecutors had bestowed upon him, Moore descended on Chicago's uptown neighborhood, his home away from jail. And there, on February evening in 1987, he came upon an 11-year-old girl who was on her way to grocery store. He dragged her in an alley, pushed her down, and raped her. For this, Moore was charged, convicted, and sentenced to 60 years with day-for-day good time. He is eligible for release in 2017, and he is out of prison. I checked on that.
Oh, really?
And Griffin and Allen, the other two, who he, even though he recanted his trial, they're still in prison and serving life without parole.
Wow.
And he got out after he did this. He's out because I found him on the Chicago sex registry, sex offenders registry.
Still living in Uptown?
Yeah. Well, actually, it said he was homeless right now.
Hmm. Probably living under the underpass there in Uptown.
Yeah. Well, you better avoid that underpass.
Uptown can be a little rough.
Make a detour. Yeah, you were there in Chicago. You might have run across this guy.
I lived one neighborhood down from Uptown.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you know, there's been a lot of talk about snitches and given the unreliability and tragic consequences of incentivized testimony, some legal authorities and not just criminal defense lawyers have called for banishing snitches outright from the courtroom. Here's the thing, and I think this is a good argument. If justice is perverted when a criminal defendant seeks to buy testimony from a witness, it is no less perverted when the government does so. The judicial process is tainted and justice is cheapened when factual testimony is purchased, whether it's with leniency or money.
Yeah, well, that's the one thing. When you're a defense witness, if somebody else is testifying against your client, you get to ask them, did they offer you anything? Do you have anything in exchange for this? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes they'll say no, and usually they don't, because what they've done is they've already charged them with something different. Mm-hmm. It's not like they said, you get to walk away free if you do this. So you still get some sort of charge.
Right.
Or they might hold off on charging them until later.
Yeah.
So there's ways around that question. So, but that's always a question you have to ask.
Now, there's been three different remedies to this that have been put forth to try to rein this in some. That it be that snitches be wired to electronically record incriminating statements made by suspects. You know, just their word alone isn't enough.
Right.
You have to actually have some type of recording in a controlled circumstance where you actually hear the words from the person that supposedly did it. Another one is law enforcement authorities electronically record their discussions with potential snitches and provide copies of the recording to the defendant. This would not be a major imposition on law enforcement since most such discussions occur in custodial settings. It merely would be an extension of increasingly prevalent practice of recording custodial interrogations of suspects.
Yeah. And that way you already have one version of it. So if they mess up on the stand and do something differently, you can introduce that to impeach them.
Right. And you also have proof if they were offered anything.
Yeah.
If that took place. Now, the third one is prosecutors disclose to defendants whether snitches, be they jailhouse informants, purported accomplices, or eyewitnesses, have received or been promised leniency, immunity from prosecution, cash, or anything else of value. The impact of this reform might be limited because the snitch system sometimes operates on implicit promises, like you were just saying.
Yeah.
Even absent a formal understanding, the reward inevitably comes because failing to deliver in one case could chill prospective future snitches. So no state has adopted either of the first two ideas, but the Illinois General Assembly in November 2003 adopted the third as part of a sweeping package of death penalty reform legislation. Also in Illinois, in any capital case in which the prosecution proffers jailhouse snitch testimony, the reform package requires a judge to conduct a pretrial hearing to determine whether the testimony of the informant is reliable.
So it's almost like an evidentiary 404B type thing.
Right. And the judge can hear what they have to say, weigh that against what they're being offered, and decide if he thinks that the guy's actually telling the truth or could be a reliable witness. They said, as of this writing, it's too early to gauge the effectiveness of the Illinois measure, but it appears to have rendered snitches less ubiquitous than they were in the recent past. In the first 11 months that the reform was in effect, in fact, prosecutors have not proffered snitch testimony in any potential capital case. So, did it act as a deterrent?
A deferent?
A deferent or a deterrent or a decurrent? I'm not sure. You know someone else that hates snitches?
Who's that?
Donald Trump.
I'm sure he does.
He doesn't call them snitches, though.
What does he call them?
Flippers.
Flippers?
Yeah. He said that flipping should be against the law. Did you see that? It was just last month.
No.
Yeah, he was upset, like, because of the betrayal of his one-time attorney, Michael Cohen.
Oh, yeah, I did see that.
And he said it's called flipping, and it almost ought to be illegal, Trump said to Fox and Friends. I know all about flipping. For 30, 40 years, I've been watching flippers, Trump continued. But if you can say something bad about Donald Trump and you will go down to 2 or 3 years, which is the deal he made, in all fairness to him, most people are going to do that. And I have seen it many times. I have had many friends involved in this stuff.
In this stuff.
Yeah.
That sounds like a legitimate quote.
But, I mean, on one hand, he's saying, well, that's not right. He'll say anything for that. But then on the other hand, he says, well, I don't blame him. I'd do the same thing if it were me. I mean, it's basically what he's saying.
I'm sure he would.
Said the Justice Department declined to comment on Trump's statement, but leaning on defendants to snitch in exchange for a reduced sentence is one of federal prosecutors' most beloved and time-honored tactics. It says, every time that Congress has considered federal sentencing reform over the past decade, law enforcement groups have lined up to warn that without the hammer of lengthy mandatory minimum sentences, they won't be able to pressure low-level members of criminal organizations to flip.
Yeah.
So they want big mandatory sentences.
That's oftentimes what happens in these drug cases, too. They make one bust with somebody, then they get that person to buy from the next person, and they go up the chain that way.
Right.
That's how they do it.
Which is what they were doing with Trump there.
Pretty much, yeah.
Now, here's an example, though. In 2014, legislators introduced a bill that would have made 2010 reductions to the 100-to-1 sentencing disparity between crack and powder cocaine apply retroactively.
Mm-hmm.
In 2010, evidently, there was a law that passed
that
took away with that discrepancy.
Yeah.
So they wanted to go back and make that retroactive. The National Association of U.S. Attorneys howled that slashing the minimum mandatory penalties will threaten the prosecution of many of the most dangerous and high-level criminals involved in drug trafficking by undermining the cooperation incentive that the current sentencing structure creates. But data shows there was no such drop in cooperation when Congress reduced the mandatory minimum sentences for crack cocaine offenses.
There goes that argument.
Yeah, so.
Can't argue with data.
Right, but, you know, they were worried. They didn't want to lose their jailhouse snitches.
Yeah. Well, it's like you said, it's a time-honored classic, the jailhouse snitch.
Yeah, they've been around forever, you know, but it's, I don't know. I don't know how you can believe that kind of stuff. Somebody offers you a deal. You don't have to go to jail. All you got to do is say so-and-so did it. Most people are going to point the finger.
No, all you got to do is tell the truth.
Right. That's what they're asking you to do.
Just tell the truth.
If you knew the truth, you already told the truth.
Well, that's going to bring us to
Legal Briefs.
Legal Briefs is the part of the show where I quiz Tommy on some different legal terms we talked about. The first one is jailhouse snitch. What is a jailhouse snitch?
Well, that's a guy that wants to get his sentence reduced so he'll say anything you want him to say. And you get him to come in and testify on behalf of your client or for the prosecution, whatever.
Well, kind of, but the reason why it is given some kind of weight is because it's considered a statement against interest. And so that comes in under one of the hearsay exceptions, is that if somebody makes a statement against their own interest, it's most likely true. Because why would somebody say that otherwise? Do you know what I mean?
Well, yeah, but if it's not concerning them, if you're just in the cell with some guy, it's like, what are you in for? Well, they got me for murdering this guy. And, you know, I never admitted that I did it, but I did.
Yeah.
Well, that's got nothing to do with you. You can just turn around and say, hey, look, he told me he really did it, even though he maintained his innocence in court. He really did it. That you're not putting yourself at in peril there.
Yeah. Well, and again, if there is something like that and there is some sort of hearsay exception to that, then the judge has, if they bring the proper motions, can make a determination about whether or not the probative value of that statement is outweighed by its prejudicial effect.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, again, another evidentiary consideration, which kind of sounds similar to what Illinois is doing with regards to the snitch thing, is they're kind of having an in-camera hearing with the judge before the trial starts to make a determination, is this worthwhile bringing in?
Okay.
the next question is indictment. What is an indictment? We throw that around all the time.
Indictment means that they have found there is sufficient evidence to bring you to trial for a crime.
And who's they?
The court, the judge, the grand jury.
That's right, the grand jury. Now, some states don't have grand juries.
Or the 13th juror.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you mentioned that. What is the 13th juror?
That's the judge that weighs in and decides that he's going to look at whether that the law was applied properly or not on a case.
Yeah, they basically look at the weight of the evidence to make a determination about whether or not the jury verdict is kind of consistent with that. So I guess it's kind of like the final check to make sure everything is the way it should be.
Here come the judge. Here come the judge. Ordering the court, because here come the judge.
Now, we talked about a mitochondrial DNA expert from New Jersey who's going to be coming in possibly and giving some expert testimony in this Eric Boyd case.
Right.
So my question is, what is the mitochondria?
That's the sheath around the DNA.
The sheath around the DNA?
Yeah.
But what?
If you say it with enough confidence, people will believe you.
No. No, not at all.
Oh.
It's part of a cell.
Yes.
Do you know what it does for the cell?
I've heard of it. It feeds the cell.
It's the powerhouse of the cell.
It's the powerhouse of the cell.
If you learn nothing else in high school, you learn that the mitochondria is the powerhouse of the cell.
Is it like a battery?
I don't know. It's the powerhouse of the cell.
All right. It's the powerhouse of the cell.
That's right.
I thought that was the biggest guy in jail. He's the powerhouse of the cell. He's all pumped up there and lifting iron.
That's the guy you want to punch in the face on your first day.
Yeah, just to prove that you don't take nothing off nobody.
I don't take nothing off nobody. See?
What was that? What was that movie? Oh, I know what it was. The Ryan Reynolds, the character of the superhero.
Oh, Deadpool?
Deadpool 2.
Yeah.
Deadpool 2. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't. I love Deadpool 1. I've been dying to see Deadpool 2.
This kid get thrown in jail, and that's what the kid keeps telling him, these jailhouse rules, and that's what he says. Walk up to the meanest one in there and punch him in the face, and this kid walks up to try to go... do that.
I might need to watch that tonight.
Oh, it's hilarious. It's great.
It's really good.
It is great. Even Mary liked it. She doesn't like those kind of movies.
Even Mary liked it. And she doesn't like funny movies.
No, she doesn't like that. She has no sense of humor. I don't know how she put up with me this long.
Thanks to everybody for listening. And thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well then, not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I...